Hey everybody, and welcome to the UFC Fight Night Blades versus Dos Anjos dissection. And before we get into breaking this main card down, there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of fight announcements, just a lot of news floating around that I want to get to. Right, one of the first things I want to talk about is Conor McGregor's coach John Kavanaugh on Ariel Helwani's show saying that he would like to see Conor McGregor fight Justin Gaethje at 170 pounds. Now, there's been a lot of debate about whether that fight makes sense, and if I'm Conor's coach, it does. And here's why, right? Here, a couple reasons, a couple things I think that you're looking at. So first off, you have to think that Conor has already fought at 170 pounds, right? So he's used to that weight class and he's used to what his body feels like on fight night. So, and there's something to carrying around extra weight on fight night. Like you saw it the first time Conor fought Nate at 170, and then he looked better when he fought him again. And then he looked brilliant when he just fought Cowboy, right? Got a little more muscle mass, but I think that can be detrimental to a fighter who has never done it before, right? Like you kind of saw when Max Holloway moved up and fought Dustin Poirier at lightweight. Poirier had a little more pop on his punches, just a little. But now if Holloway got conditioned for 155, I think he would look better there. But there's something to fighting at that weight class and knowing what it feels like to carry that extra body weight around. Now, you can't discount the fact that it might give advantages to Gaethje. Gaethje has already proven that he has knockout power. He's a great wrestler, so his top pressure might feel a lot heavier, and he might have more power in his hands, right? So you got a couple things playing here, but on paper, if you're Conor's coach, it makes sense to make Justin come up to 170 because Conor's fought there before. Not saying that it's necessary. I mean, like I said, it's a double-edged sword, right? Like, Justin might have an advantage, actually, but on paper, it kind of makes sense to make Justin fight 15 pounds heavier than he's used to, because the majority of his career he's fought at lightweight, right? Okay, so that would be the first thing I'm looking at. And the second thing is, if you beat the number one contender in the lightweight division at welterweight, I'm not saying this is fair. I'm just telling you how it fucking works, right? There's a bunch of hypotheticals that we're going to throw out here, but let's say that Khabib and Tony Ferguson fight in April when Tony Ferguson comes out on top, which, by the way, people talking about, oh, the Khabib-Connery match is huge, blah. It is huge if Khabib beats Tony. Khabib has to beat Tony in order for this to be more viable. If Tony Ferguson goes in and beats Khabib, he's been exposed in a way, and the aura, that invincibleness that surrounds him kind of drops a little bit, right? And the fight's not as big. So if you're Kavanaugh, you're thinking, okay, Tony Ferguson has a legit chance to beat Khabib. Let's say that that happens. If we make Conor fight the number one contender in the lightweight division, he has a claim at the lightweight title, but you've also got Jorge Masvidal and Kamaru Usman likely fighting for the welterweight belt in the meantime, right? And say what you want about Kamaru Usman's wrestling and Kamaru Usman being a big guy, but I think Jorge Masvidal can beat anyone on any given night. And there's already beef between Conor and Jorge. It's well known that Jorge wants the fight. The only thing bigger than booking Conor McGregor versus Jorge Masvidal right now is booking Conor McGregor versus Jorge Masvidal if Jorge Masvidal beats Kamaru Usman for the welterweight title. Now you're talking about a promotion that you can push with two guys with incredible highlight reels, two guys who are going to shit talk, two guys who are going to stand and bang, and it's going to be Conor's chance at a third world title. I mean, come on. It makes sense. And I'm not saying it's fair, and I know there are guys in that division who are more deserving of the welterweight title. But I'm telling you, if Conor beats Justin Gaethje at 170, you get the claim that he's been fighting at the weight class, he's been knocking off contenders, and it lets him go either way, right? Let's say Kamaru Usman beats Jorge Masvidal and Khabib beats Tony. Well, Conor's just going to take the best option and go fight Khabib. But I'm telling you, man, Jorge Masvidal has a legit chance to beat Kamaru Usman. And Kamaru Usman has a very good chance to beat Jorge. I'm just talking, like I said, hypotheticals here. Anything can happen. It's fighting, right? If Jorge Masvidal upsets Kamaru Usman and steals the welterweight title from him, and Conor beats Justin Gaethje at 170, Conor's going to fight for the belt against Jorge Masvidal. That's what I would be thinking, at least. I mean, that's the way I'm interpreting this whole thing. It's just a way to give Conor more avenues. You're killing two birds with one stone. You're knocking out the number one lightweight contender in the world right now, in my opinion at least, and you're beating him at a weight class that gives you a little bit of flexibility. You can claim that you've been fighting there, right? And it's Conor McGregor, so he gets what he wants. That's what I think's going on here. I think that you make Conor fight Justin Gaethje and see what plays out with the title at welterweight and lightweight, and then you take the best option. Because let's just be honest, if Tony Ferguson beats Khabib, which is possible, Conor versus Tony just isn't as big of a fight as Conor versus Jorge, right? And I mean, if Kamaru and Tony both win, he's going to have his option of what one he wants to take. And I'm guessing he would take Tony in that situation just because he wants the lightweight belt, right? And I think Kamaru Usman is just a tougher fight because he's a big fucking dude and he can wrestle his ass off. But if I'm Kavanaugh and I'm looking at the landscape and I'm looking at everything going on, you're erasing all the doubt by beating Justin. Not that Conor's going to beat Justin, by the way. Justin is a motherfucker. I'm just saying you're setting Conor up for success either way. It's an intelligent move in my opinion. All right, what else do we got? Oh, they're going to book a really exciting fight. It looks like they are, at least, between Calvin Kattar and Jeremy Stephens. And, you know, Calvin Kattar is one of the best up-and-coming featherweights, in my opinion, in the world. He just had that fight with Zabit, and he lost. And I broke that fight down, and I thought it was going to be a five-rounder. But you kind of see, and this has happened to Zabit a little bit in the Kyle Bochniak fight, too. Zabit slows down a little bit as the fight starts to wear on. And I really wanted to see what that fight looked like if it went five rounds, because Kattar was starting to come on strong, man. He's very legit, has very good boxing, and Stevens is obviously a fucking powerhouse, right? The amount of power that he generates with that fucking, all of his weapons. He's a knockout artist, and he knocks people fucking dead, man. So that's a great fucking fight. It's a good test for both guys. And like I said, it's going to be a barn burner, in my opinion. Calvin Kattar is a fucking G. So is Jeremy Stephens. I mean, it's a great fucking fight. All right, what else do we got on here? I saw another... I saw that Paige VanZant is out of her bout against Amanda Ribas, and Random Marcos is going to step in to fight her. Let's see. Paige VanZant, I just feel like her focus is kind of elsewhere. She might be injured, whatever happened, but like... This is one of those games, man, especially if you want to be at the top and if you want to be the best, you got to be 100% committed, especially nowadays, because the level of athleticism that we're starting to see enter MMA is skyrocketing. So it just keeps going up and up and up, and you get people who are learning things faster because they're starting it at a younger age. I mean, like, you look at this kid like Chase Hooper, right? He's 20 years old, youngest guy on the UFC roster, and he just beat, I can't remember if it was David or Daniel Tamer, but both of those guys are high-level kickboxers, right? And Hooper went in and dealt with them, man. I mean, showed off his jiu-jitsu and showed you that there's a new wave coming. And especially because, like, when Conor just beat Cowboy, it was sad in a way, because it's almost like, goddamn, man, you start to realize that Cowboy's still world-class, still can hang with most of the people in the lightweight division, no fucking doubt. I mean, he beat Ally Aquinta, who's very talented. Beat Alexander Hernandez, Mike Perry. I mean, Donald Cerrone's still a gangster, right? But you just kind of are seeing, like, the new waves coming, man. Conor's younger, a little bit faster, a little bit more clean with the technique. Not a little bit, a lot of it. But you're starting to see, like, these guys who have been staples are getting a little bit older, and this new wave starting to come in, right? So that's exciting. But my point with that is just, like, for Paige VanZant, if you're not staying active and you're not fighting a lot of these girls, you saw it with Ronda Rousey when she started getting, like, obsessed with stardom. And that might have just been also, like, a combination of her getting exposed and not having, like... There's this thing that happens when you're undefeated, right? And you get this, like... You have this... Like, we just talked about earlier with Habib, you have this, like, aura about you. And once someone exposes it, it's like everyone goes, oh, fuck. There's something here. Like, you don't seem as invincible to people, and you start getting exposed a little bit. And I think that kind of happened more so with Ronda, but also just the fact that she was in movies and she was doing this and she was doing that. And, you know, I think it just kind of threw her focus off, and you kind of saw the game surpass her, leave her behind a little bit, you know? I think that same kind of thing is happening with Paige VanZant. Like, you got to be fighting a lot to be relevant in the UFC, and especially if you want to stay competitive. Ciryl Gane versus Shamir Abdurakhimov. By the way, guys, I'm on MMAJunkie.com. They're, like, where I get most of my MMA news. They have such comprehensive coverage of everything. Like, huge shout out to those guys. Their site is awesome. There was something else I wanted to fucking talk about. See, it's fight week, though, so they got a lot of articles here about, Edmund Shahbazyan versus Derek Brunson is a good fight, because Edmund Shahbazyan, he just came off a big win over, I can't remember who it was, but he's a really good up-and-coming middleweight. He's currently undefeated. Brad Tavares, and that's not an easy fight. He beat Jack Marshman before that, Charles Byrd before that, Darren Stewart before that. I mean, Brad Tavares is a really tough win, and he finished him in the first round. So Derek Brunson is a true veteran in the game. He's fought some of the very best in the world at middleweight, so that's going to be a really good test for Edmund Shahbazyan. I feel like that wasn't what I want. There was one more thing that I wanted to hit on, and I can't fucking remember what it was for the life of me. I feel like there was another big fight announcement or something. Maybe not. Oh, I know what it was. Henry, this is kind of old news a little bit, right? But Henry Cejudo versus Jose Aldo. And I'm not going to lie, man. I'm very opposed to it. I don't think it makes sense. I think you've got guys who have been working really hard and doing a lot of work at 135 pounds. In particular, the names Piotr Jan and Aljamain Sterling come to mind. Those, to me, are the two most deserving contenders at 135 pounds right now. And you got Jose Aldo, who came down. And look, I mean, I talked about this in a video before, right? I feel like overall, Jose Aldo probably won that fight. But I can see how the judges see how they gave it to Marlon Moraes if you're going off a round-by-round card. Like, Moraes hit him with some big shots, hit him with a hip toss in the first, like, hit him with some... But overall, I thought Jose Aldo deserved to get the win, right? Which kind of highlights the problem with scoring. We'll save that for another day. But, so, you're coming down... And here's the thing about Marlon Moraes is he's a fast starter. You saw it in both the Henry Cejudo fight where he looked like a world beater and then he slowed down, and then he slowed down in the Jose Aldo fight as well. So Jose Aldo cuts down to 135, and I know Jose Aldo's a legend, but he cuts down to 135 for the first time, and he didn't go out and beat the fuck out of Moraes. Like, he just won the fight, in my opinion, right? Not on paper, obviously. It's marked as an L. And you just saw Henry Cejudo, I mean, finish Marlon Moraes. So you're going to give the title shot to Jose Aldo when he has, I mean, Jose Aldo looked good at bantamweight, but like, if you're gonna give him a title shot based off of Marlon Moraes coming off a loss to Henry Cejudo, I'm expecting domination from Jose Aldo. I'm expecting a knockout, a finish, or at least a 3-round battering. I don't want to just, I mean, to me, you give it to the guys who have been doing work in the division, but I'm gonna say it again. This is a business, and it's not always fair. And if the same thing with Conor McGregor, man, it's not always fair to the people in those divisions. So fuck, what can you do, you know? All right, well, with that, I think we're ready to move into the main card and start breaking this fucking thing down. Oh, one more thing. Jimmy Rivera injured out of UFC 247 against Marlon Chito Vera, which is kind of a bummer because Jimmy Rivera is obviously one of the best in the division, and I kind of wanted to see how he looked against a guy like Marlon Vera. Or against a guy like Jimmy Vera. Jimmy Rivera, goddamn, I'm mixing things up. So that's a bummer. Give me 1 second, guys. I gotta check my work laptop here. All right, sorry about that, guys. We're good. But anyway, yeah, kind of a bummer that Jimmy Rivera's out because Marlon Chito Vera is a fucking savage, and you want to see how he does against a guy in Jimmy Rivera who's been proven to be one of the best fighters at 135 pounds. But all right, now that I'm done rambling, let's move on to breaking this main card down, right? And MMA Junkie has a different fight or an extra fight listed on the main card between Arnold Allen and I can't remember who he's fighting. Arnold Allen and oh no, okay, they took it off. I was confused. I was gonna say I didn't break the Arnold Allen versus Nick Lentz fight down just because it wasn't listed on the UFC's website, but it looks like they updated it now. So yeah, let's get started. So the first fight on the main card is gonna be between Jamahal Hill and Darko Stajic, and this is kind of a tough fight to break down, man. I struggled with this one and probably the next one more than any other fight on this card. So Jamahal Hill is a guy who's 6-0 right now. This is going to take place in the light heavyweight division, 205, by the way. 6-0 right now. Coming off a second-round knockout win over Alexander Popek on the Dana White Contender Series. He's got a slew of knockouts on his record. He's a long-rangey guy. And yeah, man, he fought a guy like Daquan Townsend. He beat him via unanimous decision in a 5-round belt to win the title at KOP 62. Probably knockout something, right? Knockout promotions. Fuck, I don't know what it stands for. But fought a good fight there, showed you that he can fight a 5-round fight, which is encouraging. But he's fighting a guy in Darko Stajic who is 13-3, coming off losses to Kennedy and Shakewu, another Dana White Contender Series guy, and Devin Clark, who's a big, powerful wrestler, and they had a war, man. Like, they went to war. And Jamal Hill is obviously going to have, like, the striking advantage and stuff. Not necessarily the striking advantage, but the reach advantage. Like, he's going to be able to probably establish his range a little bit better than Darko. I don't know, man. I struggle with this fight a lot because you've got a guy in Jamal Hill who, like, he covers distance really well, but he also will, like, drop his hands sometimes, and he keeps him kind of low by his waist. And when you got a guy like Darko Stojic, who's the complete opposite, he kind of fights like this, and he's marching forward, moving head movement, and sometimes that can be a problem. So I don't want to necessarily say that Jamal Hill's going to have the advantage there. And you also can't discount the fact that Darko has 10 more professional fights than Jamal Hill does. Also, I think that you'll see Jamal Hill, like, when he gets on top, he does a good job of, like, controlling people and stuff like that. But when you put him on the bottom, he has a little bit of a harder time getting up, a little bit of things that he needs to work on fundamentally from the bottom in order to get back to his feet or, like, reestablish a guard and start attacking from the back, right? Whereas Darko Stojic is a little more experienced in the grappling department, I think. And for that reason, like I said, I watched these guys fight, and I think that this is going to – it was just a really hard fight for me to break down. But for that reason, I'm going to go with Darko Stojic. I think that Jamal Hill is probably – like I said, he's definitely going to have an advantage in the reach department and stuff. But I think that Darko Stojic keeping those hands high – and also you saw, like, he utilizes leg kicks really well. So if he can do that to Jamal Hill to kind of slow down how fast he's able to enter on things and kind of hit him with those shots and get back out, if you can slow that down – I think it'll pay dividends for Darko, and it'll also open up shots to the, like, his tendency to hold his hands low is an advantage for Darko because you can go up top, like, you can start countering with the overhand right and stuff, right? And you can, and then he'll maybe start guarding his face, and you can start attacking the body. So the key for Darko is going to be to mix this thing up and try to, in my opinion, his best avenue to victory, though, is to attack the legs and eventually take that pressure off that he's going to receive and put the pressure on Jamal Hill and get this fight to the ground, get it up against the cage and drag it to the ground. Because I think once it's there, I think once you see Darko get on top, he's going to have a significant advantage. Whereas, like, Jamal Hill might land a takedown, might get the fight to the ground. But I think that Darko will have an easier time working his way back to the feet. So I think he's going to have a decided grappling advantage going into this. And, I also just like how fundamentally sound he is on the feet. You know what I mean? He's a hard guy to put away. He's tough as fuck. He's got knockout power in his hands. Like, I think he just has more ways to get this done, and I like the experience. But here's one thing to consider too. When you're dealing with someone who's only 6-0, the leaps and bounds that this is what also makes these kind of fights really tough to predict. The amount of improvement that someone can go through from fight to fight when you're only 6-0 is pretty astounding. Like, you'll see guys who make massive, especially young guys, they'll make massive leaps in their game, and they look like almost like a completely different fighter. Like, you see it even with like Khalil Roundtree, for example, right? Like, he goes down to Thailand and he comes back and he looks like a fucking world beater against Eric Anders. So, I mean, you can't discount the fact that Jamal Hill can rapidly improve in between this last fight, especially because it was like 6 months ago. That's a lot of time in this one. So it's going to be interesting to see how Jamal Hill deals with everything that Darko throws at him. Like I said, I like the fact that Darko is always walking forward with his hands up. And, like, I think if you're going to fight like that, you have to be an extreme, like, not that Jamal Hill doesn't ever have his hands up, right? But he drops them sometimes and he goes in on things, and I think he exposes himself sometimes. I think when you're fighting a guy like Darko who just stays fundamentally sound, you have to be like a real specialist in order to overcome that kind of stuff. And Darko knows how to throw his hands, and like I said, I think he has a grappling advantage. But don't discount the fact that Jamal Hill could be improving. But I like Darko Stojic in this one by decision. I think it'll be tough for both guys to pick up a finish in this fight. Both guys are really, really fucking tough. And like I said, you've seen Jamal Hill go 5 rounds with a guy like Daquan Townsend, Daquan Townsend, though, don't discount, like, Jamal Hill's experience against seasoned guys. Daquan Townsend's very experienced. And, you know, Jamal Hill's riding momentum right now, whereas Darko's coming off 2 losses. But I think I'm going with Darko in this one. All right, moving on. We've got a women's bout in the strawweight division between Hannah Cyphers and Angela Hill. And this is kind of another tough one to pick, man. Hannah Cyphers coming off two wins in a row over Jodi Escobel and Pollyanna Viana. Before that, she lost to Macy Barber. And that was a fight where, I mean, throughout the first round, she looked good. Even dropped. I don't know if she necessarily, you want to call it like dropped. It's not like she rocked Macy, but she definitely sat her down with the right hand. But then they got engaged in the clinch, and Macy just kind of took over from there and was able to pick up the knockout. And but she rebounded, goes out and beat Pollyanna Viana, who's a very long fighter, very good on the ground, so that was a big win for her. And I just felt like she was in the Jodi Escobel fight. Jodi Escobel was able to land a couple takedowns on her, but once she got him, she was just kind of not really doing anything with the position. Whereas when it might not have been like devastating blows, but most of the significant strikes were landed by Hannah Cyphers. So, you know, Hannah Cyphers is also one of those girls who puts out a lot of volume and she never stops moving. She uses a ton of footwork, almost like a little bit Frankie Edgar-esque. Like, you know, Frankie's always like shuffling around when he's boxing, like he's constantly moving his feet. He doesn't stand still very often. Kind of like that. Little bit like her movements sometimes can be a little bit mechanical, and she can come in a little bit wide when she throws her hooks. Like they can come from a really wide angle. And I think Angela Hill might be able to take advantage of that, especially because Angela Hill is pretty comfortable fighting while moving backwards. She's a little bit slower pace. She's probably going to be doing a lot of pivoting while Hannah Cyphers is dancing around her. But I think that the key for Angela Hill in this fight is going to be coming straight down the pipe with shots when Hannah's throwing a little bit wide. But Hannah has a lot of power, man, in her hands, so you got to be wary of that as well. Angela Hill has also defeated Jodi Escobel. And, you know, this fight is going to come down to, in my opinion, whether Angela Hill can stifle the volume of Hannah Cyphers. And it's tough, though, because Hannah's not exactly lunging in with things at you. You know what I mean? Like, she's setting things up and using her footwork and then hitting and getting out. It's not like she's just charging at you. And so for Angela Hill, I think she's going to have to also be aggressive in this fight. And this – oh, man, there are some tough fights to pick on this card. I think that if Angela Hill is content with moving backwards and just popping the jab out there every once in a while, right, and just, like – trying too hard to maintain her range as opposed to establishing it, she's going to lose this fight. Just because Hannah Cyphers does like circle so much and she's rolling her shoulders a lot and using a lot of head movement and on her combos and stuff, right? She looks really good when she throws combos and throws her hands. I think if Angela is kind of sitting and waiting on things, she's going to lose because I think Hannah's kind of difficult to counter at times just because of her movement. However, if Angela Hill kind of plants her feet and doesn't let herself get moving backwards and establishes her reach, establishes her range, like I said, coming straight down the pipe with things when Hannah's throwing those wide hooks and stuff, I think Angela Hill has a good chance to win this fight. But I think in order for Angela to win, she's going to have to be aggressive and kind of be the one moving forward. I think that if she's moving backwards, it's going to create some problems because, like I said, she might be looking to counter a little too much, and Hannah doesn't run into things necessarily. She just kind of hits you and gets out. And then, you know, also something to watch out for is that, like, Angela Hill is very she's fought in a lot of high-level girls, right? So, I mean, might have a little bit more experience in that regard. I don't know, man. This is a tough fight to pick. I'm going with Hannah Cyphers, but if you start to see Angela Hill taking control of the center of the octagon, pumping that jab out there, using front kicks and teeps and stuff to maintain that distance, and I guess the term for it would be establishing distance instead of trying to maintain it, like establishing your range and making the fight happen where you want to let it happen instead of letting the fight come to you. I think she has a good chance to win this fight just based off her style. I think her striking is a little bit more fluid, but like I said, if she's not establishing the center of the octagon and she's getting moved backwards by Hannah's like footwork, it's not going to work out well for her. But if she's coming straight down the pipe and landing with that jab and throwing some kicks out there, mixing things up, I do think that she has a good chance to win this fight. But I'm going to go with Hannah Cyphers, but this one really, I mean, as all fights can, right? This one could really go either way. All right, moving into the flyweight division. We've got Jordan Espinoza, who's ranked number 11 right now, fighting Alex Perez. And Jordan Espinoza is a guy who I think he's just, I think this might be his, is this his UFC debut? No, okay. Mark De La Hoza was his UFC debut. I'm on so I'm on Alex Perez's page right now. Jordan Espinoza. Let me pull this up for you guys. Matt Schnell, that's right. Okay, so in the Matt Schnell fight, you got Jordan Espinoza, who's a pretty good striker. He's really, really fast. And again, though, he'll drop his hands when he comes in on things sometimes, kind of similar to like how Jamal Hill hold him a little bit low. Espinoza will drop his hands, and he has this one thing that he does all the time when he's getting pressured, and he throws a check left hook, and he moves off to his left. He does it all the time when you're backing him up against the cage. So, like, little things like that, he's a little bit predictable. But, I mean, his fights have been impressive, man. I mean, he lost a majority of his fights, like four fights early in his career. But since 2017, he's, like, 5-1. And Matt Schnell is no fucking joke. And I think in that fight, like, you'll see Espinoza mix things up, and he'll go for a takedown. And he went for one against Matt Schnell, and Matt Schnell just – and honestly, it wasn't timed all that bad. Matt Schnell just had, like, an excellent reaction to it. I think he caught him in a guillotine and then transitioned off to the triangle. So, tough fight, tough loss for Jordan Espinoza. But I'll tell you what makes me a little bit nervous about Espinoza in this fight. First off, he's never been knocked out, but he's been submitted 3 times. And the majority of his wins have come via submission. He's won 7 fights via submission, 2 via knockout, and 2 via... He's won... Okay, Jordan Espinoza has won 2 fights via knockout, 7 fights via submission, and 5 fights via decision. Whereas Alex Perez has won 6 via submission, but I think that his wrestling and his grappling is going to be quite a bit more advanced than Jordan Espinoza's. You saw him fight Mark De La Hoza most recently, who was he's a black belt. He's a good black belt, right? And I mean, part of this was the size too. I mean, this is what threw me off when I read that this was a flyweight bout. Alex Perez is a big guy. That fight took place at 135, and Alex Perez was quite a bit bigger than Mark De La Hoza. And you were able to see that, like, when he took it to the ground, there just wasn't much that Mark De La Hoza was able to do. And Alex Perez has been wrestling since a young age. He's got really good boxing. And, like, whereas Jordan Espinoza will keep those hands low sometimes, again, Alex Perez does not. He keeps his hands up. He's moving forward, and he's got good fundamental boxing. Really good grappling. He got into a fight with Joseph Benavidez. That was a fucking weird fight, by the way. And Perez looked good in moments. Like, he had Benavidez in trouble in some moments. Like, he was able to put him in some uncomfortable situations. But Benavidez ended up hurting him, and the ref, like, stepped in and kind of stopped the fight and then just backed away and let the fight continue on. Like, Alex Perez just kept trying to fight, as he should. Like, he did the right thing, but Benavidez was like, what the fuck? Like, I got to finish this guy twice, and he ended up getting the TKO. But that was fucked up. That was terrible officiating. But Alex Perez, man, is another guy who lost a majority of his fights early in his career. Since 2016, he's lost 1 fight, and it was against Joseph Benavidez. Let's see. 8 fights in a row before losing to Benavidez, and then he picks up a win over Mark De La Hoza. And like I said, he looked big at bantamweight when he fought Mark De La Hoza. And if this fight's taking place at flyweight, I think that Alex Perez is going to have a decided size advantage going into this fight. Jordan Espinoza is probably going to have the speed advantage, but I just think that the grappling is going to make a world of difference when you've got a guy as big as Alex Perez. I think that he's going to be able to use his boxing to set up the takedowns, and he's probably just going to be able to overpower Espinoza and grind his way. He might pick up a finish in this fight. I just think that it's going to be a matter of time before Perez manages to get this fight to the ground, and once he does, Espinoza is going to have a really fucking hard time getting back to his feet. I think Alex Perez's control is pretty good, and he's always implementing wrist control. Like, once he gets you down, he's never letting you, like, build frames off him or do anything. I think he's going to have a decided advantage on the ground, and you know, in a grappler versus striker matchup, it's hard not to go with the grappler. And especially when I think Alex Perez is going to be a little bit bigger. And when I think that he's just, I don't think he's going to struggle to get this fight to the ground. And once he does, you're going to see him kind of, I think it's going to be pretty one-sided once it gets there. The key for Espinoza is going to be being fast and getting in with your shots and getting back out before you can get hit. But I really like Alex Perez in this fight. Might get him out of there, and if he doesn't, I think it'll just be a dominant three-round decision. All right, moving on, we've got a really good fight in the welterweight division between number 5-ranked Rafael Dos Anjos and Michael Chiesa. And, you know, you just most recently saw Michael Chiesa. I think his last fight was against Diego Sanchez. Sorry, guys. I usually have this shit written down, but I have to keep looking stuff up so make sure I'm not lying. Yeah, Diego Sanchez submitted Carlos Condit before that. Losses to Anthony Pettis and Kevin Lee. Kevin Lee, there was all that debate, right? I think it was a matter of time before Chiesa did end up tapping in that position, but whatever. And in the Diego Sanchez fight, you got to see like what brilliant jiu-jitsu Michael Chiesa has. But Michael Chiesa was also a lot bigger than Diego Sanchez. And I'll tell you what, Chiesa is a hell of a fighter, man. He's a really good fighter. But in that fight, when you're fighting a guy in Diego Sanchez, who is older, who has been through so many wars, I think that Chiesa could have done more to get Diego out of there. Like, it just kind of looked like, have you ever been in the gym and you're just, like, rolling with someone who's worse than you? And you can just dominate them and stuff, and you could throw them in arm bars and, like, do whatever you want to them, right? To me, it just felt like Chiesa was just, he could have kept that pace up for as long as he wanted and kept dominating Diego, but why not throw some more strikes down? Like, you made it obvious that you're the better jiu-jitsu player. Now either hunt for the finish a little bit harder or be a little bit more aggressive with your ground and pound to get the TKO win. I don't know. I don't know if he just realized that he was going to be able to dominate Diego and he had respect for Diego. I don't know, man, but it felt like he could have hunted a little bit harder for the finish. And for whatever reason, just chose to continue to roll with him. I mean, don't get me wrong. It was, like I said, it was a brilliant performance and it was dominant and he got to put his jiu-jitsu on display. And Diego Sanchez is no fucking joke on the ground, but I think that he could have, if he really wanted to, gotten Diego out of there. My problem with this fight is that Rafael Dos Anjos, even at welterweight, has really only lost to some of the top guys. Leon Edwards, Kamaru Usman, Colby Covington. And Rafael Dos Anjos is one of my favorite fighters to watch fight because he's so good at everything. He's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. He's constant. Like, you saw against Kevin Lee. Like, Kevin Lee would put him in, like, some dangerous situations, but RDA is just so goddamn composed, man. He's confident in his skills, and you never really got the feeling that Kevin Lee was going to finish Rafael Dos Anjos. At least I didn't. Like I said, he put him in dangerous situations and stuff like that. But to me, it just kind of felt like RDA is just so goddamn good at defending himself. Like, it's hard. It's going to be very hard to submit Rafael Dos Anjos. So, I mean, let's see. How many times has he been submitted in his entire career? Once. One time. And he's got like 41 fights to his fucking name. Right? So, I think that Chiesa, his biggest weapon is his jiu-jitsu, and I don't think that he's going to be able to submit Rafael Dos Anjos. Also, like, there's something to, like, you could be a black belt, but, like, there's something to being a black belt and, like, implementing it in MMA. And to me, Rafael Dos Anjos is one of the best examples of, like, jiu-jitsu that's super effective for martial arts. Like I said, not only from his offensive perspective, but his ability to defend himself and set things up and escape in practical ways. Like, there are so many things. Like, I practice jiu-jitsu in the gi a lot, and it, like, there are just so many things that I do that in a street fight or whatever, if someone's trying to punch me in the face, just wouldn't work. Rafael Dos Anjos has, like, great jiu-jitsu for MMA, and like I said, I just don't think that Michael Chiesa is going to be able to get him out of there with his jiu-jitsu. I think that Dos Anjos is always going to be able to defend, even if he gets put in trouble. And I think that Rafael Dos Anjos is going to have a decided advantage on the feet. He has good boxing. He has good kicks. He's a veteran, and he's so goddamn composed. And he's been fighting at 170 for a while now. I think this is like his fifth or sixth fight. You saw him beat up a guy like Robbie Lawler. He ran through Neil Magny. I mean, I just think that RDA is going to be able to nullify the, any advantage that Chiesa would have on the ground, and I think his striking is going to be better. I actually wouldn't be surprised if you saw RDA start to wear on Chiesa and land a takedown himself as the fight goes on and finish this thing via submission. I mean, I don't know. RDA, just it's so hard to predict this one just because RDA has so many different ways that he could win. And I don't want to discount Chiesa, but I just think this is a big step up in competition for Chiesa. And like I said, RDA, if you want to study a true martial artist, like, study RDA. He's so goddamn well-rounded. He's so good everywhere. He's one of my favorite. Rafael dos Anjos is by far one of my favorite people to watch fight. So fundamentally sound in everything that he does. Yeah, I'm taking dos Anjos. It might be a decision, but I think that I think he could get Chiesa out of there, and I just don't think Chiesa has what it takes to get Rafael dos Anjos out of there. All right, moving on to the main event between number 3-ranked Curtis Blaydes and number 4-ranked Junior dos Anjos. And to me, there are really only like 4 players for the heavyweight title right now, and then it kind of drops off a little bit talent-wise. No disrespect to any of those guys, but you got like Ngannou, Stipe, DC, Curtis Blaydes, and Junior. And Junior is obviously a phenomenal boxer. He's one of those guys who doesn't quite look like he's ready to retire. Like, he's not he's not going anywhere anytime soon, right? Like, he lost to Francis Ngannou. He got knocked out. But like I said, Junior dos Anjos' specialty is boxing, and Francis is just a fucking – he's got a cannon in both of his hands, right? So that fight was a tough one for him because if your specialty is striking and you're fighting Francis – you might be more technically sound than him, but it just doesn't fucking matter, man. TKO Derek Lewis, beat Tai Tuivasa, beat Blagoy Ivanov, lost to Stipe, beat Ben Rothwell, right? So, I mean, Junior dos Anjos, before his loss to Ngannou, was able to string 3 wins together in a row. But the problem is that he's fighting, again, the striker versus grappler matchup, man. He's fighting a guy in Curtis Blaydes, who, I mean, if they got into a pure boxing contest, yeah, Junior dos Anjos might win. Like, he probably has an advantage there. But Curtis Blaydes has very good boxing, and he's – my favorite thing about Curtis Blaydes when I watch him fight is that he's relentless with the takedown attempts, but it's not just that he's attempting takedowns. It's that he's setting it up with the hands first. Like, he has crisp boxing too. Very good fundamentals, and he just, like, he sticks – he's one of those fucking guys who goes in there and he knows what he wants to do and he just sticks to the game plan and rides it out the whole way through. If he takes the guy down and the guy gets back up, it doesn't discourage Curtis Blaydes. He's also got tremendous cardio for the heavyweight division, and he just keeps fucking, like I said, he knows his game plan and he fucking sticks to it. He'll keep hunting that takedown, and if you stand back up, he'll just start chaining, he'll chain wrestle and take you back down. And he'll set it up with the hands first so that the timing is there on shots. I mean, Curtis Blaydes is a fucking animal and a real problem for anyone at heavyweight. His only losses have been to Francis Ngannou, and I'm favoring him in this fight, man. It also, I mean, the fact that I train at Easton Training Center in Centennial, and his head coach is they're all downtown, right? So it's kind of hard to pick against him. Admittedly, I'm a little bit biased and I don't know the guy personally or anything, but just the fact that I go to Easton, I'm going to pick Curtis Blaydes. But also, just in my heart, I really do believe that this is a tough matchup for Junior dos Anjos. Because, like I said, if they got into a pure boxing match, Junior dos Anjos might have an advantage. And not that he can't catch Curtis, and not that he can't knock Curtis out or string something together that looks brilliant. But realistically, I just think that the pressure and the pace and the fact that Curtis Blaydes has good enough striking to set up his takedowns is going to be a real problem for Junior in this fight. I think you're going to see he's patient with the stuff, man. But once he gets you down, it's like it's almost like he'll paw things out right and he'll wait for that opening. But once he finds it, it's almost like he's exposed you. And then he'll just keep exposing it over and over again as many times as necessary. I think Curtis Blaydes might have the most takedowns in the heavyweight division. And, honestly, I think it's going to be a pretty dominant, unless he gets caught with something. I think you're going to see a pretty dominant performance from Curtis Blaydes. I think it'll take a while to get Junior out of there just because Junior's a veteran. He knows how to, like, again, a big part of fighting that people discount is the ability to defend yourself and keep yourself safe in dangerous situations. So I think in the first few rounds, you'll see Curtis land a couple takedowns. Junior might get back up. And even if Curtis is able to hold him down, Junior will be defensive. But as Curtis continually keeps pouring it on, I think you're going to start to see Junior Dos Santos weather. And I think you're going to see – I think you'll see a late round finish from Curtis Blaydes in this fight, probably between like the third and the fifth. Like I said, man, I just think his wrestling is one of the – is probably he probably has the best wrestling. I know Daniel Cormier is up there. No disrespect to that man. He's a fucking – obviously an Olympic-level athlete. But I think Curtis Blaydes has some of the best wrestling in the heavyweight division. He sets things up well. And like I said, it's like – once he finds that opening, he just continually hunts it. And it's like once he lands that first takedown, you're kind of fucked. Like it's like he's found out that he can take you down and now he's just going to do it. And like I said, I love how he sticks to the game plan. He knows what he's good at and he knows how to set things up to get to where he wants the fight to go. So I'm going with Curtis Blaydes late round TKO KO. And don't forget, too, that like Curtis Blaydes has power in his hands. I mean, these are big boys throwing hands. They're throwing hands around. He could knock Junior Dos Santos out on the feet, too. So I don't know. Unless Junior clips him with something or hits him with a really nice combo, though, I like Curtis Blaydes. But I think that's going to wrap this one up. I think we covered everything. I moved this podcast over to Anchor, and they automatically distribute this to like places like iTunes, the Google Play Store, Spotify, Breaker, whole bunch of podcasting platforms that I've never even fucking heard of. So if you guys are interested in listening to the audio version of this, check us out on, I mean, whatever your favorite podcasting, hosting, whatever you use to listen to your fucking podcast. And if you're listening to the audio and would prefer video, we also have this on YouTube. So check us out there. Hit the subscribe button if you guys like the content. And let me know what you guys think in the comments. I think that covers everything, guys. Thank you again for tuning in. And bye-bye. All right, I just recorded this whole fucking thing, and the whole time I felt like I was forgetting something, and I definitely was. On the prelims, there's a kid named Montel Jackson fighting, and he's one of the most talented kids in the bantamweight division. He's, ton of potential. He's a real up-and-comer. He's dangerous everywhere, and he was kind enough to record a podcast with me a while back. If you guys go back in the archives and stuff and look at for episode 13, it's titled Montel Jackson, UFC Bantamweight, the name of the podcast. Go ahead and check that out if you guys want to hear a really interesting interview from him. We did it over Skype, so it's a little bit spotty at times. That's my fault. But he had some really interesting stuff to say about his time in Thailand and his volunteer work helping kids in like wrestling programs, et cetera, right? And he was a really, really nice fucking guy. And he talked to me for a while. We did like almost, I think it was like 45 minutes maybe or something like that. So it was awesome to get a chance to speak with him. And like I said, he's one of the most promising prospects at 135 pounds, and he's fighting on the prelims on ESPN+. So please make sure to check him out and give the podcast a listen if you guys are interested. Thank you.